Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 19 minutes or so after 9 a.m. on the 26th of April, 2022. I do apologize for the late start. We're getting closer to the end of the session, two-year session, so we have a few distractions along the way, trying to keep things moving forward. So with that, we'd like to go ahead and welcome Senator Bishop to the table. Senator Olson, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Wilson, and the other members may join later. There's other meetings going on. We have one item on the agenda this morning. The committee is going to hear a presentation dealing with cybersecurity and the administration's FY23 requests. In the budget, it's sprinkled to the budget like a salt shaker. And I thought it would be nice to have a presentation giving us a little bit of public information on the issue and the risk at hand. So presenting today will be Mr. Bill Smith from the Office of Information Technology. And the committee's been joined by Senator Hoffman. So if he can come forward, jump in the chair. I think you may not need a lifeline. So we'll see how it goes. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent. I think you have a presentation you want to walk through.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Smith. I'm the Chief Information Officer. I'm in the Department of Administration. I'm the Division Director for Office of Information Technology. I'll be joined today on my right. My financial lifeline is the Department of Administration Administrative Services Director Leslie Isaacs. So I definitely appreciate the opportunity to come to speak to this body on cybersecurity. It's obviously something that is on everyone's mind globally recently. Within the Office of Information Technology, cybersecurity oversight is housed in our State Information Security Office. And we have oversight of cybersecurity for the executive branch of the state of Alaska. Cybersecurity is our top information technology priority, and it's woven throughout all of our enterprise systems. Although we do cover the executive branch, we do work closely with the IT leadership in the legislative and in the courts branches as well to make sure that we've got a unified picture of the threat that's out there. So with that, I'll go ahead and begin. So on the agenda items, what I wanted to do was first kind of give an overview of the cyber threat landscape. What we're seeing, kind of the drivers that have resulted in the current environment, and then how that's impacting the state of Alaska. We'll also cover some of the cybersecurity incident costs, which help frame the discussion about expenditures, as well as those FY23 security requests that are in the budget, throughout the budget that you mentioned. And then I'll be going deeper into our specific cybersecurity ecosystem, how we view it, and then how we are addressing it with initiatives within the state. The graphic that you see on the right-hand side of the slide is simply a framework for considering cybersecurity, and it allows us, it's generated by an organization called NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and it's how we organize our cybersecurity systems and our security office to help us better manage and reduce cybersecurity risks. I'll move to the next slide. What we've seen over the course of the last several years in terms of cybersecurity threat is almost a perfect storm. We've seen resources coming into the cybersecurity threat actor groups from nation states as they become larger players, so they're resourcing these groups. We've also seen the industrialization of capabilities, automation of capabilities, so the barriers of entry are coming further and further down. I recently saw a report that a cyber attack would cost someone about $200, and you can get on the dark web, you could contract it out, and then the smart cyber folks would launch it against your target of choice. That's how prolific it has gotten, and that is one of the perfect storm factors that really has caused a large proliferation. And we've also seen a transition to use of cybersecurity actions as a cybersecurity threat as a geopolitical tool. So in addition to the cybercrime aspect, which is indicated on the slide, is about a $6 trillion annual industry. There's also the geopolitical aspect where actors are partaking in intrusion attempts, not for financial gain, but just to get either information that can be used by geopolitical groups or for reputation or social media information and various things like that, so to in order to influence public opinion. So all of these things kind of played together for a large escalation over the last several years. The results for State of Alaska, just to put it in a little bit of context for us, in 2021, we saw 87 million malicious emails blocked, and those were the ones that never got through. There were others, several that did get through, and we were able to take care of once they got to the intended employee. But just within our State of Alaska employee base on the executive branch, that's 87 million that were identified as being malicious and that we blocked. An even more startling statistic is in terms of the network-based attacks or attempted intrusions, scans from unauthorized folks, things of that nature. Our systems have captured about 8 billion with a B per month over the course of 2021. So it's important to understand the context of the issue that we're dealing with as we discuss the efforts that we make to protect the data of Alaskans within the state government. The bottom line is that security at this point is no longer an IT issue. It is a whole of an organization issue. It's something that everybody has a role, whether it's an employee that's logging onto their email, whether it's a front office employee who's picking up a phone, or it's the IT professionals that are managing the systems. Everybody has a role, and our task is to make sure that we communicate that and we provide them the right tools. Are there any questions on this slide before I move?
No. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the last couple of years, there have been attacks on, I know, Division of Elections and Department of Health and Social Health and Human Services. And have there been other successful attacks on any of the state computer systems?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, to some degree, we have had incidents. We have had issues where there was a cyber attack that was then it got into our environment and then it was handled. It was isolated, contained, and eradicated. I'd prefer to go into detail on any of that in an executive session if we're able to do that. I don't necessarily want to go into extreme detail. I will tell you that any indication or any incident where information was exposed is required by law to be reported. So the ones that have been reported are the ones where information has been exposed. There are, you know, when we look at cyber attacks and incidents, we track everything from a lost laptop computer that there was no repercussions from to the much larger incidents. And so we've got a range of incidents that we're tracking, and I could give you that full lay down if appropriate.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski, and then Senator Bishop.
Have any of these attacks made demands on the state for money?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, of the attacks that we've had, I'm not aware of any monetary demands. You know, if we look at the spectrum of the attacks that some of which are listed on the slide, ransomware obviously is the one that's getting the most attention in the press because it is a significant issue. About 10% of the cybersecurity incidents that have been reported globally are some form of ransomware. But ransomware is sometimes detected before it actually comes to fruition and you understand that it fully is ransomware. So. To answer your question directly, I'm not aware of any request for money that the state has had, but we are aware of the environment and the threat of ransomware as a potentiality.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, could you repeat that $8 billion comment you made? $8 billion, not dollar, but $8 billion. I was writing another note, and I didn't get all that.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, over the course of 2021, we had an average of 8 billion network-based attacks blocked per month.
Thank you.
And that's a wide range of types of events that would include targeted attacks against State of Alaska assets, but it would also include what we consider to be spray attacks, where you have some a threat actor that is just sending out automated attacks, pinging every IP address or every address on the web and trying to find one that's vulnerable. So it's kind of that entire spectrum.
Okay. Go on to slide 4, please.
All right, thank you, sir. So as we look at the incidents and we try to put into context the cost that they have, the global cost right now of an average data breach is about $4.2 million. That's a global average. It's higher in the United States. Typically, it's the reporting that I've seen. It's right around $9 million per incident in the United States. And it can also be impacted by the industry and all of those specific elements and the type of attack it is. Globally, public sector organizations are typically showing an average of about $2 million per incident. And the biggest reason for that is because these dollars do include lost business for private entities, and that's obviously not a factor in the public sector calculations. But it just goes to show that there is a significant cost on the cybersecurity incident side of the house for breaches, and we have seen about a 10% increase over the last year of that cost as it continues to materialize. The costs vary significantly, but they do provide some insight into significant factors that we can use to mitigate and reduce potential costs to the state as we navigate the cybersecurity environment. Those areas, organizations that have high compliance requirements, so those organizations that deal with a lot of personal identified information, health care information, financial information, they typically cost higher when it comes to an incident. And then there's also ransomware, which we mentioned earlier, which typically is a little bit of an incrementally higher increased cost per the average incident. So they vary, but it also tells us, and I'll talk to, I'll reference a few price points or cost points throughout this presentation with some of the preventive measures we're taking and the impact that we see of those measures on average cost around the state, around the globe.
Okay, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're just looking at the supplemental costs of just this year's budget, and I think there's a few million dollars just to address the past year cyber attacks. Has the state looked at and the cost benefit of cybersecurity insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. We have been looking at that. We've been looking at that closely with the resource management, division resource management. And cybersecurity at this point is not a good option, or cybersecurity insurance is not a good option for the state. It doesn't do anything to obviously limit your exposure to cyber attacks, but it does help you address the financial on the backside. What we've seen in the industry, though, is that the actuarial tables around cybersecurity incidents have really been skewed by the proliferation of the attacks, and they haven't really recovered. So what we've seen in many policies is that they're really very restrictive. Several policies are doing things like omitting ransomware as a covered act. They're also looking at deductibles that are as much as 25 to 50% of the insured amount. So we're pursuing an internal path, working with risk management on internal cybersecurity insurance.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have any state actors been identified in attacking Alaska's computer systems?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we've seen state actors that are associated with various nation states, both. Really all over the globe that we've seen activity coming towards the state of Alaska. Very few in terms of targeted attacks, but we have seen but a lot of nation states, both from the Ukrainian region has been and Russia, those have been very big players that we've seen, again, not targeted, but in general, as well as several other nation states. So we do have a little information along those lines that I could share with you, but again, I prefer that we do that in an executive session.
Follow up.
Can you talk about the breach on the Division of Elections and who was responsible for that and what information they obtained?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't have the details around that specific breach in terms of the information that was that was obtained. I do know that that was a it would fall in the category, I think it was on the previous slide, of a supply chain attack, where it's one of the categories of attack that we're paying very close attention to, where threat actors try to infiltrate the code of applications that are then sold to various organizations, and so it's kind of embedded there. That type of attack is one reason why organizations really try to do good code review and do some other things. And there's some movement that we've got within the cybersecurity environment to try to help us defend against that.
Follow up.
Was there any attempt to change the election outcome?
And through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, not to my knowledge, I don't have any level of detail around that.
And I think that's something that Alaskans are concerned about, is it attempts to change election outcomes. How confident are you in the security of our elections data?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm very confident in terms of the work that we've been doing to protect the integrity of elections. Just over the course of the last year, we've had specific targeted assessments, audits, working with the Center for Information Security and Analysis, CISA, which is a part of the Department of Homeland Security, working with them to come and look at our systems. We just had an exercise with them where they came in and tried to do some penetration testing in our environments at the beginning of this year, working with the department, or the, correction, the Division of Elections. So we've been spending a lot of attention not only on elections, or overall network, looking at the fidelity of the network and looking for vulnerabilities that we can mitigate. And at this point, from what we've seen in the exercises and the work that we've done, I'm very confident in the level of integrity of the election system based on the cybersecurity posture of Division of Elections.
Okay. We'll go on to slide number 5.
All right, thank you, sir. This is the list of the FY23 budget cybersecurity requests. The first three are Department of Administration requests, and those are the ones that I'll be speaking about in a little bit more detail during this presentation. But there are a few others that are specific to other departments that are included as well. The bottom two, DMVA, Homeland Security, State, Local Cybersecurity Grant Program. We're working with DMVA on creating and administering that grant program, but there is a request in there for some matching funds for federal grants. And then Department of Health Information Technology Assessment. For any questions?
Any questions on the slide? Senator Wilikowski and then Senator Wilson.
Thank you. These proposals that have gone out, have they what's the process by which you put these out? Is it I assume there's an RFP, number one, and then do you pick the lowest bidder? Do you pick is there some sort of an evaluation to determine which is the going to provide the highest level of security? What's the process that you go through in putting out these bids for cybersecurity?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it is a competitive process. Quite often we utilize NASPO tools, which is a National Association of State Procurement Officer competitive process. They do a competitive process over the course of every few years, so that there are standing programs that have been competitively assessed and awarded, and we can leverage as signatories in that process. And that allows us to rapidly find competitively sourced vendors. In terms of selection of the vendors, generally on the IT side of the house, you know, we start with the requirements. What are we looking for, and then who are the best able to perform that work? But we also look closely at integration with our existing systems. One of my concerns in terms of cybersecurity is that if we introduce or maintain an environment of very diverse systems, we have a lot of gaps and we have a lot of areas where there's potential for vulnerabilities to reside and develop, and they're harder to maintain a security posture against. So we look for integration, and we look for are they suitable? Are these vendors suitable with our environment? Do they have experience with the type of technology that we have in our environment now and that we're moving to standardize on? So those are in general the terms that we look for. All of these have gone through competitive process, as I said. I can't speak on the two that are outside of Department of Administration. The ones that are within Department of Administration have gone through that process. I'm trying to look. They've been the vendors that we're looking at for those have been through either the NASPO. I believe they've all been NASPO, but I'd have to double check that.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The state is sort of approaching cybersecurity in sort of a hodgepodge sort of mentality. I mean, so what's the state's plan to cover all our sensitive data when all the departments aren't fully integrated into OIT?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's one of the key points that I want to provide to you here in the next couple slides. That unity of a view and the consolidation of IT is one of the critical pillars in terms of strengthening our cybersecurity posture, in my mind. And I'll explain a little bit why on further slides. But that is very important for us to have a unified view of cybersecurity throughout the executive branch.
And just if I could, Mr. Chair, you know, the state's spending about 26 million, I think, this year, or the request started off in this year's budget process was about 26 million. Has the state, I don't think since 2006, has done a statewide assessment of our IT security needs to make sure what we're doing is the right thing? Is the state looking at doing or integrating a sort of a statewide audit to make sure, maybe in conjunction with the cloud migration and some of our security upgrades, just to make sure this is what we're doing, this is the best thing for our $26 million investment, that we are doing the right thing? I don't think we've seen sort of an assessment or make sure this is the right path that we're going down.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, to some extent, some aspects, not a complete cybersecurity-focused assessment, but during our APEX program, our APEX project, where we brought in external partners to assess the maturity of our IT infrastructure across the state, our IT environment across the state. That addressed some of the aspects of cybersecurity, such as governance, such as organization, those types of things. And it also looked at the cloud migration path and potential impact, more on an operational side than a cybersecurity side, but that was a component of it. We have not had a specific cybersecurity audit, to my knowledge, in at least since I've been with the state, in the last 2.5 years. It's definitely on my radar. We've got a new chief information security officer that we brought on towards the end of last calendar year. I've been just frankly prioritizing it with the other things that we're trying to accomplish on the cybersecurity side, and making sure that we're putting our efforts where they provide the most security fastest. I want to get an overall assessment done, but I've got to program it in where I've got the resources to support it. Those types of external audits are extremely valuable. They provide a lot of great information, but even though they're conducted by third parties, they require a lot of time and effort on State of Alaska employees that are in those functional areas. And so that's one thing, as we sequence when it's the right time for us to do that, that's one thing that I'm looking to consider.
Okay, and just one more question.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We know that data has been breached in other departments in the states in the past couple of years, and that currently some of that data might be being used today to try to game the system in the state of Alaska. What are we doing to validate some of that data that may have been stolen and securing our systems that's currently being used?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, we really look at it as a little bit of a larger issue than just what data may have come through the state of Alaska and gone out. Because of the prevalence of identity theft and because of the prevalence of breaches in the holistic environment, We really have to assume that compromised data is around us at all times. And so a couple of the things that we're doing on that, both on the cybersecurity side, in terms of our State of Alaska employees, you know, multi-factor authentication and several other zero trust, and I'll speak to those a little bit in further slide, several other zero trust elements are being integrated into our environment. We're moving down that path for State of Alaska employees. For external to State of Alaska, folks that interact with the state, we're really looking hard at our fraud, our anti-fraud, our identity verification capabilities. Coming up on about a year ago, we instituted several new capabilities within the MyAlaska platform to specifically combat automated fraud and bots that were trying to gain access into the State of Alaska environment through MyAlaska. And we've been very successful with that program. But we were running into situations where over the course of a couple of days we would have millions and millions of attempted logons. They weren't getting through, but they were shutting down. It was a denial of service, basically. They were shutting down access for Alaskans. And so we instituted a platform to help us with that, and it's been very successful to combat that type of activity. So between the cybersecurity protections that we're putting in place and the anti-fraud path that we're pursuing for Alaskans and other folks entering into the state for services, those are really the two primary avenues that we're focused on.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, regarding some of the bigger breaches, Department of Health and Human Services, PFD division, where people's data was compromised. Number one, did the administration comply with the notification requirements to Alaskans that their data was breached?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, to my knowledge, the administration did. Whenever we run into a cybersecurity incident, on our side of the house, on the IT side, we're solely focused on what exactly happened and how we can identify, how we can contain it, how we can eradicate it from our technical systems. In terms of the types of information that may or may not be affected, we look to the business owners, the ones that own the relationships with the governing bodies and the federal government agencies that establish those requirements for reporting, and they handle that side of the house. So we're not, on the IT side, we're not directly involved necessarily with notification schedules, but to my knowledge, all of those were complied with appropriately.
And has the administration been subject to any lawsuits from because of identity theft in the last few years?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, not to my knowledge. I'm not aware of any.
Follow up again.
Has the administration provided any identity theft remedies to people whose identities have been stolen or information has been stolen?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't have firsthand knowledge of that. I believe it's been discussed, and I believe that was part of the remediation for the business owners of data that was potentially compromised, but I don't have a role necessarily in providing that remediation. We're focused on the IT systems.
If you don't have the answer, just state you don't have the answer. You'll get back to the committee. Don't stretch yourself out and make a misstatement.
Okay.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, on that, we had that hearing in Health and Human Services earlier this year on cybersecurity, and my understanding was that you use the PFD division's data to notify basically all Alaskans that their data was at risk. So basically all Alaskans would have to be provided the remediation.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, on the Health and Social Services side, that incident, the potential pool of folks that needed to be notified were determined by the data that went through the system that was compromised, and that was handled and identified by Health and Social Services. So I don't have any information on the specifics.
Okay, just a statement then. I think that was data that was anybody that went through the system of public benefits, public assistance, current and past data, and that's why they use such a broad net to cast. And so I just didn't know if we can get that answer back from HESS on the remediation on how many people have utilized that and the cost to the state for that would be helpful.
So we've been joined by Senator Von Imhoff. The committee will go on to slide six, please.
Thank you, sir. So in slide six, I want to start to address kind of how we view cybersecurity and how we get our arms around the efforts to make sure that we secure the state's data. Really, you can look at the ecosystem as a combination of people, technology, and processes. On the people side, as I mentioned earlier, cybersecurity really is a whole of organization effort. And so there's significant training that needs to be done so people are aware. They know how to identify suspicious emails, et cetera. Within the executive branch, we conduct annual cyber training. We are also getting ready to initiate within the next 30 days or so a routine monthly cadence of test phishing emails sent out to validate that our training is being successful. And if we see that we still have a significant number of employees clicking on it, then we'll adjust our training plan. But those are the types of things we need to do to be sure that people are aware of the threat. On the technology side, I'll speak to two of these in follow-on slides, but we really focus on network architecture. How is our design of our network postured to keep us safe now and in the future? And then on the systems side, are our systems up to date? And are our systems comprehensive around the state? Do we have any gaps? And by those systems, we're referring both to our security-specific systems as well as our enterprise systems as a whole. And on the bottom, the processes, we want to make sure that we're organized to support compliance and incident response. And to the point made earlier, this is where consolidation becomes key because we need to make sure that we've got a comprehensive view of our security posture and potential vulnerabilities. Any questions on this slide?
One next slide.
Yeah. So the first of the two remaining pillars that I want to talk about on the technology side is the environment. And this is where the cloud migration comes into play. Network design, the network design that we have today was developed over decades. It was developed over a very decentralized government. And so it contains a lot of silos. We also have experienced over the course of many years, as many state governments do, a significant amount of technical debt. And so we've got systems that have that are a little long in the tooth, that have been around a while. And we have some of that residual that is in our current network. Cloud migration is the most rapid, cost-effective path to mitigate that risk and to position us for the future. And I'll go through why cloud migration makes sense from a security perspective, and then we'll talk a little bit in the next slide about the project itself. So if you look at the graphic to the right, that is just used to kind of explain the difference between on-premise and in the cloud. In the on-premise column on the far left, all of those blue elements are things that State of Alaska does today. We're responsible for all those elements and the security, lifecycle management, and all aspects of taking care of those elements. As you move to the right, you've got a couple different types of cloud computing, all of which are available in the cloud. But depending on the way that you put applications into the cloud provider assumes responsibility for certain elements in that stack for security. So, for instance, the equipment that you provide or that they provide for their cloud in their data center, they're responsible for making sure that it's modern, that it has lifecycle replacements on time, that it is receiving the proper patches, and that it's got physical security controls. So those are – I just use that as an illustration of the cloud. It tends to make things a little bit easier for me to explain at least. On the left-hand side, I will go through several areas where – security interest drives us to the cloud, and it shows us the areas that the cloud really helps us. On the shared security side, as I mentioned, the vendor is responsible in all of those scenarios for the hardware associated with the cloud. The vendor will make sure, and they do make sure, that the hardware is patched, that it's up to date, and that the hardware is compliant with whatever compliance regime we've contracted them for. What that does for the state of Alaska is it frees up significant resources. So today, when there's a vulnerability somewhere in the world, and you can think of any of the ones that you've heard about in the last year, and we need to react quickly, the manufacturers create the patch. In a cloud scenario, the manufacturers then make sure that their cloud environment is patched, and it's done relatively quickly, it's done very efficiently, it's transparent to us. And you can think of if you have cloud-based email, if you have Google email, or if you have Microsoft Outlook in the cloud. Outlook, Google email, they're patched continuously, and you never see it. It's the responsibility of the cloud provider to do that. In the on-premise environment, we're responsible for getting the patches from the manufacturer, and then we're responsible for getting them into our automated systems or manual systems, and then we're responsible for going through the 3,000-some servers that we have in the state, or in the case of desktops, upwards of 15,000 devices, making sure that they get patched, making sure that that we go back and check that they've been patched. And we do that in a continuous cycle. So it's an incredible amount of resource dedicated to that effort, that we free up that capacity in a shared security environment. Next, the secure foundation, it really does speak to that technical debt that I mentioned. It allows us to rapidly move to modern equipment that, that is designed with today's cyber environment in mind. There's also some structural benefit, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but if you're familiar with a distributed denial of service attack, structurally the cloud is much more resistant to that than a data center type environment. As we get down to the built-in controls, this is where I mentioned compliance regimes. There are dozens and dozens of compliance regimes with elevated security standards that are prepackaged, pre-designed, pre-configured in the cloud environment. Those are things like HIPAA, those are things like CJIS or Criminal Justice Information System, things around federal tax. All of these elevated compliance environments, the cloud has prepackaged, pre-configured environments that we can utilize. One of the best reasons in my mind for arguing for the cloud migration, though, is that bottom piece, global threat intelligence. The manufacturers of the cloud, the vendors of the cloud, regardless of which vendor you go with, they've got a global presence. They are in tune with the cutting edge of what we're seeing cyber threat, and they react very, very quickly. And what we want to do by leveraging this environment is reduce the amount of time that we are vulnerable when a new vulnerability comes out. They're going to keep coming out. Their attacks are going to happen. If we can shrink the amount of time that we're vulnerable, then we're much better off. The cost survey that I showed earlier speaks to this specifically. In their study, they showed that cloud modernization, a mature cloud modernization at an organization, reduced the amount of time that it took to identify and contain a breach by 77 days on average for an organization. And so that is 77 days that that potential breach is not running around your network, is not causing havoc. So the speed of reaction, as well as freeing up the capacity for our professionals at the state, are two really critical reasons why the cloud makes a lot of sense from a cybersecurity perspective. And any questions on this slide before I get to the project?
Thank you. Smith, can you talk about, you know, we're in the post-pandemic situation where COVID have sort of shifted our workforce, and we have a large percentage of folks that are currently working from home. How will this technology or cybersecurity sort of change for your department with sort of an at-home work base?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, it helps us significantly in terms of access, and in two aspects. One is on the cybersecurity side. Depending on the type of application, it allows us to go directly to the cloud in a secure environment from the user. So if folks are at a rural location or somewhere around the state, it allows them to connect, depending on the application that they're using, connect in a secure manner directly to that cloud environment. And it allows us, as a result of that, to reduce the use of virtual private network tunnels back to our core network and then going to the data. So there's that aspect of it. The other aspect of it is from a resilience standpoint, we're not stovepiping all of our data in two locations. If our data is present in the cloud in a very controlled, very secure manner, we are not beholden to specific fiber pipelines. So, for instance, an example would be if the fiber connectivity to Juno gets cut. When that happens, whatever data we have in our Juno data center is potentially isolated. And it might be available for folks in Juno, but it might not be available for folks elsewhere. data in the cloud, if the bulk of our state data is in a cloud environment, in those types of emergent situations, it would still be, we might have isolated enclaves of employees, but those that are not in that area would be able to get full access to the rest of the data. So that resilience in an emergent situation is kind of an operational benefit, but on the security side, it really does allow us to unshackle from some of the more cumbersome and costly data center and network structures that we have in place today.
Thank you.
Next slide, please.
Thank you. So this is the outline of the cloud migration project that is that has been requested. The scope, as I said, is to assess and migrate about 3,000 servers. We've got roughly 3,000 servers in the executive branch. They're located throughout the state in about 64 different locations. We've got 64 locations that have two or more racks of servers at various places around the state. So the intent would be to assess them, make sure that the contents of those servers, those applications, are suitable for moving to the cloud, develop the statement of work timeline, all the professional services involved there, conduct the phased lift and shift at a large scale so that we push the data into the cloud and that we can minimize the amount of time it takes us to be able to take advantage of the security benefits of the cloud. Some longer-term modernization would be deferred under this plan until after the migration. The intent is that we focus on the security benefits, and the modernization would be part of life cycle development of applications, et cetera. It wouldn't be a cloud migration piece. It would be just a modernization of the software. In terms of return on investment, what we've seen so far is we've got 93 servers that we've had in the state of Alaska Azure instance, and we're seeing the cost there about 25% less than our current chargeback rate for departments for servers, for on-premise servers, which is consistent with the data that we've gotten from industry. We've looked at several studies, worked with several partners to determine what we could expect in terms of return on investment, and that's consistent. One of the aspects that is a significant challenge for state of Alaska is our complexity. We've got over 1,800 different applications on about 77 different developmental platforms or languages. So there's a lot of complexity there, but what we've seen so far is consistent with industry. We were also asked to provide information on what an on-premise alternative would be, and I will tell you that I don't think that there's an apples-to-apples comparison on-premise. We could move forward on-premise and try to maximize the benefits and get as many cloud-similar benefits as possible, and we estimate that would be about $40 million over 5 years. To collapse all of the 50% of our servers and data environments into our data centers so that we could then try to add as many of those cloud-like security offerings to our data centers and modernize several aspects of it. But we still would not be getting all of the cloud-based security benefits. And then it would obviously be a life cycle issue. After about 5 years, we'd be starting to see some additional aging and life cycle replacements. So I don't feel that the on-premise is a viable option in terms of the security concerns, and I really don't think that we can afford not to go to the cloud from a security aspect.
Okay. Questions? Senator Wachowski.
Yeah, have we made any major tech IT investments in, say, the last 5-10 years that are now obsolete because of the rising risk of cyber attacks?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we've got a significant amount of technical debt. The last major refresh on our network was over 5 years ago, more like in the 8 to 10 range. Our data centers have been kept for the most part up to date, but where we have a lot of technical debt is in the 50% of our servers that are distributed in 62 locations around the state. The replacement model for those has typically been on an extended period, looking at capital purchase requests, as well as kind of, hey, if we have operational funding left over, we can go look at some modernization. But we have a significant number of dated servers. We also have a significant number of well, of data servers that we are tracking as known vulnerabilities that we're actively trying to mitigate as a threat reduction activity.
Follow-up?
Do you, should the committee expect any significant capital requests in the next several years to deal with these cyber threats?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I appreciate that question. With the cloud migration, we have scoped this to allow us to get the bulk of our data, as many as possible of our existing servers and applications, into the cloud environment, which would really move them to more of an operational model in terms of cost. We would no longer have significant swings in capital requirements for a lot of equipment. There could be potentially cost for software and things of that nature, and programs on a security aspect that we might see the need for in out years. But as a related to specifically to the cloud migration, I would not anticipate significant capital expenditures because we'll be shifting more to that operational model.
Senator Bishop.
I might have missed it. I was out, and I apologize. And if it's redundant, you don't have to answer it, and I'll get it from my colleagues. This cloud storage server, is it repository, is it in Alaska or outside of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it is outside of Alaska. The Azure environment that we are using for the initial large-scale lift and shift is a Microsoft public cloud product, and it resides in data centers all over the world, but they do not have any in Alaska. Our instances would be in the Northwest, and we would also have a higher level of security for those most secure items, which would be down in the Southwest of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wilson.
Hey, Mr. Chair. How long is the estimated time for a full cloud migration for the state of Alaska, and who's first, who's second? Do you have a priority list of how that will work in the departments?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, sure. The large-scale lift and shift, this is we're utilizing tools, technical tools, that will allow us to move large groups of servers simultaneously. And so right now the expectation is that we are going to be doing roughly a two-phase project. The first phase would be our Juneau and Anchorage data centers, and then the second phase would be the remaining servers around the state. Each of those phases would include cross-sections of the departments. And so that's the model right now. We don't have a firm timeline. Our expectation is that we would not be seeing it exceed 18 to 24 months from the time we start. But we're going to try to pull that in as closely as we can.
Senator Wilikowski.
If we're transferring most, if not all, of our data to Microsoft Azure, what's the security record of Microsoft Azure?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. The security record for Azure is really very good, and it's better than most premise-based systems. All of the public cloud environments are designed with zero trust type of capabilities to allow us to ensure the security of those systems. We like to talk about them in terms of moving servers from our data center into the cloud. It's not exactly the same architecture in the cloud, and so there are structural aspects that make it more secure. So, for instance, what may be on one server in our data center, when we move it to the cloud, it might be distributed via algorithm across multiple servers in various racks across a data center location. So just the structure makes it more secure. It's also fully encrypted at rest as well as in transit in that environment. So we're very confident with the safety record, the security record within that environment. We still have a requirement and an obligation to make sure that we don't leave the front door open, though. We have a role in ensuring the security of our data, and we'll take that very seriously.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just on that feature, I thought Azure had a major flaw in 2019 when Microsoft uploaded a new feature which left about 2,300 folks vulnerable to attack. And that feature was automatically uploaded into all customers of Azure in 2021. So were our networks vulnerable to that flaw in the network?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I'm not specifically aware of what of the one that you're talking about and whether our network was involved. Typically, large-scale vulnerabilities are going to be crossing paths, and they're going to be going and be affecting multiple environments. But I'm not aware of that one.
All right.
Next page, please. Slide 9.
Okay. So the other aspect of technology that I want to briefly address is our enterprise systems, and that's both the productivity systems as well as the security-specific systems. And I provided a graphic as an example on one of the things that we've done to improve our security level, but also to do it in a way that streamlines our workforce efforts and provides us for a little bit more capacity. Within our Microsoft collaboration suite, prior to about 18 months ago, we had the E3 level. Nothing significant about the naming convention, but the point that I want to make is as we upgraded to a higher level with an incumbent higher operational cost per employee, we did it so that we could get access to multiple security programs as well as multiple additional productivity programs. And so I use this as an example to show that even though we may not, that we may have IT budget items that don't necessarily say cybersecurity right up front, but they all have a cybersecurity nexus. Those programs that are outlined in red are the ones that we are completing implementation of under the security tool implementation request. We've implemented most of them, but we still have a few to finish up on, and we want to do that quickly, so that's the reason for that request. The other request that we wanted to cover is the Managed Security Operations Center request, and I want to thank this body for supporting and moving forward that request earlier. It was done after this slide was prepared. But that is going to allow us to increase our incident detection and response capability, and also by utilizing partners that have worldwide intelligence gathering capability, it'll allow us to proactively look in our network before we have issues for things that maybe pop up elsewhere in the world. So it's going to be a big capacity add for us in the state and allow our state of Alaska employees to have the bandwidth to be more proactive and do some other things and deeper dives and other vulnerability assessments that we really want them to take and spend some time on. So those are the two aspects, if there are any questions.
Okay, next slide, please.
The final pillar on that stool is the process pillar, and as I mentioned, this is where consolidation becomes key. We're doing all of those things on the right, but we need resources to do them better. We need more time to spend on them. And IT consolidation allows us to streamline our environment, get a better single dashboard view of the environment and vulnerabilities so that we can make sure that we're protected. That capacity is grown from not only IT consolidation but also cloud migration and bringing on board those operation center resources. So all of it kind of ties together in giving us more capacity on the security side. An interesting statistic that has been studied recently is that about 98% of cybersecurity or cyber threats can be combated with good basic protocols executed uniformly. And so while I certainly am an advocate for specific security platforms, we can't forget the basics and our ability to enforce the basics and monitor them. And that's where consolidation comes in play. The only other thing that I'll highlight on this slide before I mention briefly Zero Trust is in terms of cost of incident recovery and cost of breach, there is also a correlation between complexity of environment and higher incident costs. It might be a little intuitive, but the more simple that an environment is, the more easily you're able to identify those incidents faster, and you're able to respond to them more quickly. We have a very complex environment in the state of Alaska right now, and a lot of our efforts, consolidation, working with those additional tools that I highlighted in the previous slide, cloud consolidation, all of those things are really aimed at simplifying our landscape so that we can see it more clearly, react more quickly. The final comment on this slide is just on zero path. I've mentioned it once or twice, or zero trust path, rather. We're already starting down that path with multi-factor authentication. Really, it's just changing from an environment where you think of your security as being protected by a moat, and you start to not trust any actor that's trying to get data from anywhere in your environment, and you make sure that an individual is explicitly authorized and has a reason to access data before they do it, as opposed to, well, they're in our environment, and so they must be okay. And that is a path, as I said, we've already started on. It's a multi-year continuous path. But if you hear zero trust kicked around, that's exactly what we're talking about. And the capacity to really granularly identify our users and their roles is critical to that. And, any questions on this one? Then I have just one kind of concluding statement.
I think this is your final slide.
This is my final slide, sir. I would just, kind of in a wrap-up statement, obviously we've got an extremely high-threat environment that's increasing. It's not going down. We've got very talented and dedicated security and IT professionals within the state workforce, and they are protecting the state extremely well given the challenges. One breach is too many, and so we are obviously working to have zero breaches, zero incidents. But I will tell you that the team, that given the size of the threat and the size of the environment that's out there, they've been doing a great job and working extremely hard. The reality is we can't maintain the status quo, and so in those improvements, we're looking to improve all of those three pillars: people on training, technology with the cloud, as well as the other systems, and process with consolidation. So, pending your questions.
Any of the committee men, you know, I could request a private meeting with the department to go into more detail on your questions, and depending on how those meetings go or requests after that, there's always a possibility that the committee here could go into executive session and discuss it further, but I'd rather try to start with the individuals and individual meetings with the department to see if we could avoid the executive session time frame. So that concludes the presentation this morning. I'd like to thank Mr. Smith for coming forward, going through the threat process and the cloud with us, and the budgetary requests that are significant, and the concerns that the committee members have to protect the public's information that the state holds, and also the state information. So at 1 o'clock today, we'll reconvene with a new meeting. We'll bring up committee substitute for Senate Bill 164, which is the capital budget. This will not be the final capital budget bill. It's a committee substitute with most of the stuff in it, but it'll, like the operating budget, be a step closer to May 18th in the final budgets. So thanks, everybody, for coming. We are adjourned.